Joe, we're back for episode 77.
Wow, how portentous. It's odd how these numbers just appear miraculously out of nowhere.
Yeah, is this numerology or working
here? Well, you're talking about the armistice, right? The 11-11.
Yeah, we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the, the cessation of hostilities in World War One, the Great War, November 11th, 1918, and Armistice Day commemorates that. Armistice Day is commemorated every year on, this is according to Wikipedia, on 11 November to mark the armistice signed between the Allies of World War One and Germany at Compiègne, France, for the cessation of hostilities on the Western Front of World War One, which took effect at 11 o'clock in the morning on the 11th hour, 11th day, 11th month of 1918. I think we'll talk about those numbers later on. The armistice initially expired after a period of 36 days. Formal peace agreement was only reached when the Treaty of Versailles was signed the following year. The date is a national holiday in France and was declared a national holiday in many allied nations. In some countries, Armistice Day is coincides with Remembrance Day and Veterans Day and other public holidays. The first Armistice Day was held at Buckingham Palace, commencing with King George V hosting a banquet in honor of the President of the French Republic during the evening hours of 10 November 1919. The first official Armistice Day events were subsequently held in the grounds of Buckingham Palace on the morning of 11 November 1919. This would set the trend for a day of remembrance for decades to come. In 1919, South African Sir Percy Fitzpatrick proposed a two-minute silence to Lord Milner, of all people. This had been a daily practice in Cape Town from April 1918 onwards, since being proposed by Sir Harry Hands, and within weeks it had spread through the British Commonwealth after Reuters correspondent cabled a description of this daily ritual to London. After the end of World War II, most member states of the Commonwealth of Nations, like United Kingdom and as Canada in 1931, moved most Armistice Day events to the nearest Sunday and officially began to commemorate both World Wars. They adopted the name Remembrance Day or Remembrance Sunday. Other countries also changed the name of the holiday just prior to or after World War II to honor veterans of that and subsequent conflicts. Apparently, World War One wasn't the war to end all wars. The United States chose All Veterans Day, later shortened to Veterans Day, to explicitly honor military veterans, including those participating in other conflicts. I think that was 1954. In the United States, Veterans Day honors American veterans, both living and dead. The official national remembrance of those killed in action is Memorial Day, originally called Decoration Day, from the practice of decorating graves of the war dead in years immediately following the American Civil War. Some, including American novelist Kurt Vonnegut, and more recently American veteran for peace Rory Fanning, have urged Americans to resume observation of 11 November as our Armistice Day, as a day to reflect on how we can achieve a peace as it was originally observed. Let's see here. And that's Veterans Day, or now Armistice Day. Again, change to Veterans Day. So, Joe, what's your take on this special day?
Well, it's a sad day. I mean, World War One, which incidentally, the Armistice Day that's coming up is the 100th anniversary, mm-hmm. and that of the original armistice, and that is worrisome to me. I'll go into that in a little bit, but the thing that I think is just most important, I mean, I just don't want to waste any time getting to it, is that the war was completely orchestrated, it was artificial, and there's actually a very, very concrete piece of evidence to that. I mean, this isn't just analytic logic and you know, comprehension. When Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, the license plate in his car read A111118, which can be read Armistice 11th November 18. Now, you know, underlying how clear cut this is as you know, the kind of predictive control that the oligarchs like to have with their numbers is all of the foreknowledge of 9-1-1. You know, this is just now legendary, all of the different films and album covers, you know, that portrayed 9-1-1 before it happened. So that date somehow had this kind of Masonic meaning, and therefore was understood by a wide group of people as when, you know, the towers were going to be struck. And when you see the Archduke's license plate, you need to remember that you mentioned that actually that ended, that, you know, was the cessation of hostilities. But then the Versailles Treaty was then actually signed quite a bit later. And that was on the day that Ferdinand was assassinated, 28th of June, 1919. So that you know, I think that the idea that these, you know, could be, you know, circumstances far-fetched, and obviously World War One was, you know, created by the political class that had come under control of a secret society. They controlled both sides of the conflict. And that's why the war was fought basically in without any logic from the perspective of, you know, military victory. But the trench warfare was just to hold populations in place so that the machine guns could reduce the populations of the European. I mean, that's what World War One was. And then this would weaken Europe, I think, in general, so that then when World War II was then brought about, you could have eventually the just complete slaughter of the German people. That was the German people were the basically the receptacle of the Holy Roman Empire. It was a very Catholic country. The Masons have a relationship with, in my opinion, with elite Jewish groups, and World War One was just the beginning of basically the destruction of the European, and also a kind of revenge for the war that occurred in the first century, which basically was when I think you know, the oath structure of the group, the Freemasons, was established at that point. And as long as I'm in just such a cheerful theme, I'll conclude by saying, you know, I'm very worried about the current Armistice Day. And I mean, I actually have been worried about a couple dates during this year, and I'll tell you why. 30 years ago, The Economist magazine ran a cover which had on it the headline, "Get Ready for a World Currency." And it was a phoenix rising up out of the fire of fiat money. And you could see the dollars and the pound, various currencies were there burning. And there was a date on the metal around the phoenix neck, and the date was 2018. You know, The Economist is a Rothschild-controlled and owned magazine, and so I thought that could be like the you know, armistice number on the that they had put the license plate on the Duke's the car he was going to be killed in. That this was just a way of you know, demonstrating their control over history by placing the number of the date when the currency would end. And so this then particularly shook me up a little bit, because they recently ran they called their 33rd special edition of The Economist, which is not a number that you really are hoping to see. And it had, they just said, "The World in 2019, and the cover has no color. It is simply white and black, you know, the Masonic white and black. And so this would suggest, if I'm reading the symbolism right, that 2019 is not going to be a great year for the non-Masons. And if in fact, then this is, you know, their kind of representation of how they're going to control history and their power over it, then what I would imagine is that you could have a very bad kind of financial situation occur. Notice that the banks will be closed Monday. And then just one final little paranoid illusion. They have a memorial in Phoenix, Arizona. Notice Phoenix, you see. And it's to the veterans. There are five obelisks, and through them, a sun can pass. And the sun will pass through them on 11 a.m. and 11:11 this Sunday. So there's a lot of 11s, Tim. And the sun passes through, and what does it illuminate? It illuminates the seal of the United States, you know, with the phoenix, basically, or the eagle. And so that's just, you know, I've had, you know, I've made other predictions about these, the potential of dates and things. And the armistice, I could be just about as wrong as I have been in many others. I'm just mentioning this because, you know, we need to, when we look at something like World War One, and we can see now all of the control that was in place, you know, to destroy Europeans, we should really do everything we can to understand, you know, our world as it is, you know, symbolically representing the oligarchs, right? We should really be trying to understand this. So that was my little take on the armistice day, Tim, is that I'm worried it could be the beginning of a financial reset where currency will stop working. So, I mean, this is very far-fetched, and I'm not suggesting that this is somehow likely. This is just, it's just that there's just too many 11s lining up, so to speak. So that's what I think about the armistice. It's a Masonic holiday or celebration, basically, of the destruction of the European. Did I lose you, Tim?
I'm sorry. You're talking about the events leading up to the outbreak of war, and you know, Chris, the standard history account treats it like an accident, almost like there's this, the spark is the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. Then there's these series of diplomatic missteps, and alliance systems, and nationalism is the villain here, because you have this militarism and nationalism and these armies, and of course the solution is one world government, the League of Nations, and these things. And the same sort of narrative is kind of culled out of the Second World War. We need a world government. I guess people have looked into this, know that, you know, the, obviously the organization that perpetrated the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand was tied to British intelligence, Freemasonry. And this, if you look at British strategy going into the war, going into the 20th century, it was to sort of to provoke a war with Germany, because Germany was becoming too strong economically and industrially, and British Empire just simply couldn't compete anymore, and they needed a war to knock Germany down. And of course, we shouldn't look at these things in terms of nation states. You have to look at these transnational relationships, particularly the bankers, and how they network is through Freemasonic connections, the lodge system. This is how you, organize high level malevolence and conspiracy through such a system. And you know, of course, you talk about the Rothschilds. Of course, there was the Warburg banking family. It was stationed both in the United States and Germany, who were agents of the Rothschilds, who perpetrated the war, started it to get their war. Of course, then they also conspired to prolong it. There are many instances of Germany actually trying to sue for peace, get an armistice long before November 11th, 1918. But they needed the war to last a little longer to crush German power. And this is a case of, the governments aren't really in control here. At least, you know, the personages that we think are running the show aren't really running the show. They're just they're front people, and you have all these bankers working behind the scenes. A good illustration of that would be, of course, during the First World War, you had all the intrigues that led to the Bolshevik Revolution, and we see Western bankers all over that with the funding of the Bolsheviks and these things, both German, American, and British. You also have the Balfour Declaration coming out of the First World War. And that was, pronounced a British conspiracy working with Jews in the United States to exercise Jewish power to get America into the war for the fulfillment of the Balfour Declaration, the British victory, Allied victory over Germany. Obviously the war isn't what we were told at the time. And if you look at Armistice Day, at least going back a century, there is a lament associated with it, meaning it was more like looked at as a sorrowful event, because and so there is some feeling that people there are some acknowledgement or cautiousness among the general population that they had been had, particularly in the United States. You had the interwar period of congressional investigations of the merchants of death and how much fraud was involved in these things. No one is ever convicted, but at least there's some public recognition of these things. So there is some recognition that the war had been a disaster, and there wasn't quite, at least from my reading of history, there wasn't quite the treatment of veterans. You had Veterans Day memorials, you had parades and these things, but these days weren't there to honor war. It was more to acknowledge the sacrifice of the veterans. But since then, it's been transformed into promoting war. It's become a warmongering opportunity, particularly Memorial Day and Veterans Day, and these things. It's where war is celebrated. The military is celebrated, and there's no reflection on the realities of these wars. We talk about the lies that led to the First World War, but we can talk about the lies that led to almost every war. I can't think of any war that's been fought. Generally fought for the reasons that are presented to the public. There's always some ulterior motive. I mean, in 1898, you had the Spanish-American War, and that was fought for the interest of National City Bank and the sugar interest, and you know business interests wanted to knock out the what remained of the Spanish Empire in the Caribbean and also in the Pacific, so they could gain a gateway into China and maybe get a better foothold in there, competing with the European powers. Of course, World War One. Of course, World War Two draws out of the consequences of World War One. Even then, you have intrigues and these things where, it isn't just a question of naked aggression on part of the Japanese and Nazi Germany. You have those countries being maneuvered into war through various embargoes and these things. So none of these wars are fought for what the public is told. We can talk about shoot ahead towards Korea and Vietnam and those wars. Both Korea, you can look at the post-war situation in Asia, was set up for both the Vietnam and Korean War to eventually occur. I think it's L. Fletcher Prouty, I forget if it's his book on the Kennedy assassination or his book, The Secret Team. I think it's on the Kennedy assassination. He writes about how after Japan surrendered in August 1945, all the materiel that had been armaments, munitions that had been stored for the anticipated invasion of the Japanese mainland, were shipped half to Korea and half to Vietnam. And a lot of those weapons, surplus weapons, were used by the communists to fight the wars there. Both Korea and Vietnam were divided, north and south, right? One communist north, and pro-West South, setting the stages for a civil war. So these wars were all sort of planned out, and it didn't take a genius to look at the map and say, hey, we got a problem here. Dean Acheson himself said that, Korea saved us, because he had famously declared Korea to be outside the U.S. defense perimeter in the winter, late winter of 1950, and of course the Korean War started in June of 1950 when North Korea attacked South. And he later said that, I think, a quote, he said that Korea was very successful because it set the stage for what they called collective security. And what's collective security? Well, collective security is a step towards world government. And that was the objective here of those wars, to establish the precedent of One thing is President unilaterally starting a war because Truman did not get a congressional authorization or declaration of war against North Korea. He called it a police action, and that's one thing that the UN Charter sort of set up. UN Charter was signed. It sort of undermined the constitutional requirement for Congress to declare war. And since then, no president has ever asked Congress to declare war. You could also make the same argument about the Vietnam War. Of course, the Vietnam War achieved another end. I think Vietnam's war objective was primarily domestic and economic, the transfer of huge funds to the military-industrial complex through the wasting of war material and treasure in Vietnam, but also the alchemical effect the war had on American society of that time, because at that time, American pop culture and mass communication, you could use the war to radicalize and divide the public, which it did. And that kind of rendered society and set the stage for the sexual revolution and the 70s and so on. So these wars are never fought for what our leaders claim they're fought for. In the 1960s, you had two incidences. You had the Liberty incident where Israel attacked, tried to sink an American NSA surveillance vessel, and you had the Gulf of Tonkin. The only difference is the Liberty event really did happen. The American people weren't told about it. The Gulf of Tonkin event didn't happen, but they were told about it. It tells us a lot about the nature of war, doesn't it? So,
yeah, it's interesting. I've looked at wars in just a general sense, and what you can see is prior to the basically this century, the Masons were involved in all of the wars. You don't have as clear-cut sort of Jewish elite family influence. They're less visible. What you see are Masons. Like as an example, the Civil War, where you have a Masonic presence in the North, and then Jefferson Davis, who is a Mason in the South. He's and then secret societies around him. He's actually operated by Skull and Bones, people with relationship with Skull and Bones. If you look at like Fort Sumter when it was shelled, both sides of the battle were led by Freemasons. Mm-hmm. And so the thing the study I'd like to see done is basically is Masonic, influence and control in the starting of wars prior to the 21st century. And just to see exactly, who is who. Because if you look at like even the Boer War, you can see the Masons were on both sides of that. It seems to me that what you have is Freemasonry gaining political control and then using it for population reduction. And this is a theme. It's a technique that occurs just over and over again. And so after the fact, you get, or even before the war goes on, but certainly afterwards, you get narratives, the Vietnam narrative, whatever that was, whatever explanation they have. They have the Gulf of Tonkin, but they also have the domino theory. There are lots of kind of rubbish that they give to the public so that they would believe that the genocide had some kind of justification. I mean, what happened to Germany following World War II? You see the narrative, but when you dig into the Masonic influence on both sides, right? I mean, certainly the Bolsheviks. And now it's interesting because with the Bolsheviks, you started having the emergence of Jewish power. The Bolsheviks had there was Masons, but like, for example, in the Hungarian Soviet in 1919, following the war, the basically Catholic population tried to basically exterminate the Masons because they realized that they had worked to bring about the Hungarian Soviet, mm-hmm. that they were instrumental in it. Bela Kun and Gregor Lukos, those guys were working with Masons. But you also had just a really large fraction of the Politburos in the Hungarian Soviet, and certainly in the what was the Russian Soviet, 95% are Jews, and the documentation on that is pretty good. It isn't some kind of conspiracy theory. So there you have the emergence of kind of a Jewish control, but it works with Masonry. You know, there's you never find some kind of antagonism between the two groups. They're always able to somehow organize themselves and cooperate to the extent that they get to reduce population. That just always seems to be, they are able to cooperate to that extent. You know, I would really like, you know, you look at like the, you talk about the Vietnam War and the alchemical effect that it had on American culture. You know, you look at some of the like Laurel Canyon rock and roll people like David Crosby, and you can see that they're just a 100% Masonic family. The Grateful Dead were, you know, very proud of the fact they were all, you know, from Masonic families, and all of their imagery in the original events that they did were, you know, just out and out Freemason symbolism. But, you know, other families are more mysterious, like the Morrisons. You know, on one hand, you had Admiral Morrison, and then the other, you have Jim. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of, you know, Masonic imagery in Morrison's songs, but I've never heard anyone accuse him of being a Mason. The Admiral, as far as I know, there's no evidence that he was a Mason. But one interesting thing about the guy is that he was a specialist in New Testament Greek, which is always a, you know, a tip off, because the Masons are so focused on the New Testament. This is what they're operating against. And then Admiral Morrison placed a epitaph on Jim, his son's grave in Paris, which was, you know, what he did because of his own demons. And he used the word from, you know, the Conic Greek, which is in the New Testament. And that's very important because, you know, that word is related to, you know, in the New Testament, to Lucifer. And I think that they have a different way of understanding the book of Revelation specifically. So the question is like, well, you know, how vast is the secret society? And I don't think you can, you know, even though you can see a lot, like, for example, in the assassination of the Archduke, at the trial, Kabrinovic, he talked about, you know, he was a Mason, and he was, you know, he had gotten basically orders from Freemasonry to do it. It was kind of known. I mean, it was quite astonishing if you go through the transcript that they understood that Masonry was basically had basically condemned the Archduke. And, you know, it's just that you see this and it's clear cut, but then when you go out into the political class, a lot of these people are not, you can't really identify them. You don't know who the heck they are, like the Churchills. I mean, obviously, the Churchills, they're that's easy because they're a Masonic family, but there are, you know, high level individuals that are difficult to pinpoint as to where they are in the whole process. But I would just say that, you know, you have elite Jews and Freemasons in some kind of a guild or an association. And then you have what can be called WASP elites, mm-hmm. you know, Rockefellers and things like that. And I just put those people as a question mark. I don't know what they are. I mean, William F. Buckley.
Yeah.
You know, now, when you get into like Buckley being in Skull and Bones, I just slide him. I don't see that as anything other than a Masonic organization. So I just put him in that class. But as we, you know, as we come to, you know, yet another Armistice Day, to me, instead of celebrating, obviously this is a mistake, you know, because there's really nothing to celebrate, or even to, you know, commemorating the sadness of families that have fallen and died in these times, we should be using this the day to remind us that we have lost political control. This is really what the holiday should be. Is that it should remind Europeans that there is a society that controls our political class, our financial, our media. We are not, and they represent themselves falsely to us. And so this should be what we commemorate. I just want to sum up. I wanted to give a shout out to my grandfather, who got mustard gassed in World War I and then passed away in the 50s. But, you know, I mean, he was just based on the you know, I never really have a good memory of him, but based on his poetry, just seemed like a really great guy. And he represents to me the slaughter of the Europeans, you know, that has occurred because we have permitted a secret society to gain control of the political class. And, you know, rather than just feeling horrible and tragic about all this, we should honor his memory and the memory of all of the hundreds of millions that have been slaughtered. And so that's that's my screed on Armistice, Tim. It should inspire us to you know, do more work to uncover how this catastrophe has occurred.
Yeah, part of the catastrophe, how they occur and how they continue to occur, is the fact that we memorialize them, by memorializing them, we perpetuate them. This isn't to say we can't lament the death of those who perhaps in good faith went off to fight to defend their country or to expand or defend freedom, but that's a lie, and that's an ugly truth. It's an uncomfortable truth. But the problem is the reason most Americans need to think of themselves as righteous, or their country as righteous, and their country as being good, and these things, and these are all, you know, nice sentiments, I suppose, or feelings. But this isn't the truth. I'm sorry, it's not. These wars have not been waged, nor have they been fought to defend their family or their community or their country from foreign aggressors or invaders. It simply isn't the case. There's a good example of a big lie is, you know, about this is in 1899, in a speech defending the military campaign in the Philippines, the U.S. military campaign in the Philippines. This was, of course, part of the Spanish-American War. President William McKinley assured his audience that the war was not for treasure, for conquest, because such wars are foreign to American character. And he said, "No imperial designs lurk in the American mind," McKinley declared. "They are alien to the American sentiment, thought, and purpose. The sole purpose of sending U.S. troops to the Philippines," he went on, "was the welfare and happiness and rights of the inhabitants of the Philippine Islands." You know, that was out of Stephen Kinzer's book, The True Flag. So we continue to, you know, have these myths about these wars, and this perpetuates them, because to call the Second World War a good war, you know, or to say that somehow in Korea or in Vietnam that we were defending the United States is ridiculous on its face. And also, we deny the crimes that have been perpetrated in the process of waging these wars. I was reading about the Vietnam War, how you had the December bombing in December 1972, and supposedly this got North Vietnam to the bargaining table, and a better deal was struck. Where it turns out that the terms by which North Vietnam agreed were the same terms that had been agreed upon the previous fall. It was completely unnecessary. But nevertheless, the next month, I think January, February 1973, the U.S. Air Force dropped 250 million tons of bombs on Cambodia. This led, of course, to the rise of the Khmer Rouge and the subsequent genocide there, something that the United States actually supported at an arm's length, because they were anti-Vietnamese and I believe Maoist. So goes the claim. But that is just how vicious, I mean, and so we're supposed to commemorate that. I mean, you commemorate, you know, the war, and, you know, soldiers are doing this, soldiers are perpetrating this. Your veterans have to do these things. They're the ones that are flying the machine, flying the airplanes and shooting, you know, shooting the rifles. You know, we talk commemorating the sacrifice of our troops in Vietnam. Well, let's talk about Operation Phoenix. What went on there under Operation Phoenix? This is just a reality of these wars, not to mention the firebombing of Tokyo or Dresden during the Second World War, or the fact that I think 90% of all cities in North Korea were flattened during the Korean War. And I think it was the first time that we used napalm was in Korea. Yeah. Most of it falling on civilians.
And then now we have, you know, different kinds of propaganda. I think we should point out, you know, just how they are able to keep us from rioting at having these wars go forward, they create a lot of motion pictures that are very sophisticated propaganda.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. I mean, but they have a lot. They have just a ton of them that are set in the Middle East now.
Mm-hmm.
And you have kind of these hip, fun Americans who always get in these Jeopardy situations. The Muslims are ghouls and basically inhuman. And there's a Jeopardy situation, and the Americans rally to one another. They don't leave some guy out in the desert. They go and get him, and they lose people. But they find ways to create this idea of oneness, with the soldier. And then they have, we've talked about the militarism at the sports events.
Mm-hmm.
This is the other half of that propaganda theme, where, then basically the love of the soldiers and the sense of belonging into this group of soldiers, they're us, then it just is, it's just a perspective people have. And so then that basically makes it hard to criticize the war in general, because they have the foot soldier basically, between criticism of the war and the public.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me in that they're kind of killing them twice, they kill them on the battlefield, but then they sacrifice them as a way to keep war from being protested. They use them again. They are constantly bringing out people with missing limbs and things at football games, and they do that so that the population identifies with the with the fallen soldier and not with the political process that created a just completely insane war.
Yeah, and this is how, so far, like, militarism has integrated into mainstream America. We used to be somewhat alien to it, really, before World War II.
Yeah.
But I think Nick Turris wrote a book called The Complex, right? I mean, just how much military spending distorts and affects the U.S. economy and how many industries are dependent upon it. You mentioned sports, of course. I think the NFL has like $100 million contract with the Pentagon.
Yep.
Which is why, if you watch, last week I happened to, 2 weeks ago I was watching a game for some reason, I caught it, and everyone's wearing fatigues. I mean, Army, all of military, and it's some promotion thing, So yeah, it's everywhere, if you think that, our veterans, our soldiers are defending the country, do you really think that, when I hear reports of two soldiers, American soldiers dying in Niger or in the Horn of Africa somewhere, that this is done to defend America? Or the fact that you have NATO or U.S. forces supporting operations in Syria or Yemen, which is a genocide which is being perpetrated by our proxies, the Saudis, as some sort of proxy war, supposedly against Iran. This is to defend the United States. This is absurd. And none of the details of Yemen, what's going on the ground there or what's going on in Syria are really reported to the American people. The news is out there if you want to find it, but it's really not talked about. And this goes to our talk about last week, how useless the political electoral process is, because none of these issues of like war and peace, which are meaningful, are being even talked about in any context in any of these political campaigns where supposedly policies decided.
The big political issue is Tucker Carlson had his house broken into by Antifa.
Yeah, and this is the function of these George Soros operations, is to get us all bogged down in these hire a bunch of loonies to go riot. So we all focus on that.
We have, as a people, we have been led astray, in terms of the armistice, I would hope everyone would share the license plate. I mean, it's such an obvious visual thing, and it just shows that we got to start looking behind the curtain a little bit, because we need to bring up sort of the fingerprints of the oligarchs so that people will use them and like as a way to basically resist the propaganda. You know, I was sent you know, a video that I passed along to you about I think his name is Slotkin.
Oh, the Plotkin.
Plotkin, excuse me.
Dr. Plotkin, yeah.
This is a YouTube video that I hope gets a lot of play because it was his, he was deposed in a lawsuit and he basically lifted the veil on vaccination experimentation and admitted that he had not only experimented on, you know, what he referred to as mentally retarded children, children of the poor, prisoners, but on colonial, basically, you know, populations, millions of them. Mm-hmm. And this is all done as an experiment. And so, you know, if you look at the Wikipedia description of this guy, you know, it's we always start out the show with a Wikipedia description of the theme. And I mentioned last week that this is really great that we have Wikipedia because it saves us the trouble of constructing the propaganda, you know, presentation of the subject. They've already done it for us. You know, this is the way that the oligarchs want you to think about the world. You know, Wikipedia is obviously vetted. Plotkin has this Wikipedia piece where he's this, you know, basically combination of Santa Claus and, you know, Mother Teresa. But then you actually have here fingerprints. You know, you can actually listen to him talk and listen to how cold-blooded he is. You know, just time after time saying, yeah, we did it, we did it, we did it. Because what happens is the lawyer has documents. I don't think this Plotkin character would have admitted any of this, but it was clear that the lawyer had documents. I don't know enough details about it. I'm going to find more out about this and try to talk about it more in the future. But what is available is absolutely chilling, and it's a tremendous, you know, I would call it sort of energy boost for people who are basically, you know, wanting inspiration to go further in terms of research into, you know, the oligarch class, because you really get to see when he talks about experimenting on humans in the millions. I mean, Mengele doesn't, even the fantasies about him that are presented in history don't measure up to what this guy actually is. He's like Cameron, you know, on steroids, my God. And so this is what we're up against. I mean, you know, the public has the distracting elements, you know, the motion pictures, which create this idea of brotherhood, you know, and which extends up to the political class. But at the same time, we're just getting genocided, you know, every single day, you know, just around the clock. They are wiping us out in terms of our capacity to reproduce. They are damaging, you know, our strength and our intellects. And then they're reducing our numbers. I mean, basically, you know, when you think about like the vaccines in light of, you know, Archduke's license plate and all these other things. I mean, why do they do it, Tim? It's because it creates a tradition of allowing the government to get underneath your skin.
Literally, yep.
And it's exactly what it's for, mm-hmm. You know. And then they're learning every single day more and more about how to put things underneath us to bring us to a delta or epsilon class, let alone wipe us out. Because I think a lot of these things reduce, you know, fertility. You know, when you're looking at, I got some information a couple of days ago about further declines in the sperm count, and they're also talking, you know, I had wondered about this, that the motility of the sperm, the ability of the sperm to be active, has also dramatically decreased. So it's not just the number. People might think, well, you know, there's billions of sperms, who cares, you lose half. No, the sperms are damaged. And so I think the next set of data that's going to come out is going to say that these sperm, these damaged, slow-moving sperm, produce weakened humans. And see, that's when you really can see what's going on. You know, this is what they're after. And so, you know, and that's what they were studying, you know, like, because I mentioned to her earlier my position on this, the colonial vaccination experimentations on millions of people. Why are they doing this? This character, Plotkin, is, I mean, he is, he couldn't be more of a rattlesnake. The idea of him trying to help anybody is preposterous. What are they studying with vaccinations? Well, they're studying the, you know, the way it damages. This is what they're after. So, you know, this is, you know, when you get to armistice, when you get to Veterans Day, we're looking at commemorating, you know, our destruction as a people. And I think that we should, you know, not be swept up by the pageantry and the propaganda aspects of it. It's not a great day to try to open the minds of the public, because people do have legitimate emotional connections into fallen family members and things like this. But people who are clear-minded, people who understand what's going on. I mean, we should just use the day as inspiration, Tim, try to, you know, just do a better job of alerting the public as to what's going on.
Yeah. The one of the an example of the duplicity. We talk about some of these wars. We think, you know, you fight a war, obviously you want to win it, right? But neither Korea nor Vietnam were fought in a way that you know, towards victory. If you look at it militarily, it could have been, would have been, should have been an easy thing to win militarily. But in Korea, what happens is, you hear about Korea, you have the invasion, then you have Incheon, MacArthur drives all the way up north, well past the 30th parallel, up close to China, and then China, unexpectedly invades, and attacks, and MacArthur, at that point, ordered the bombing of the bridges going across the Yalu River, where the Chinese troops were pouring across. And it was General Marshall countermanded that order, which allowed hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops to continue pouring over the border to kill American troops, UN forces, 90% of whom were American troops. Why would he do that? I mean, I'm sorry, by bombing the bridges, was that going to start a world war with China or Russia? Yeah. No, I mean, obviously, because they wanted the troops to pour in, because they wanted the situation in Korea to stabilize, which it eventually did along the 38th parallel. MacArthur, I guess, thought of himself as a soldier, you know, like Patton, maybe, you know, things like that. So that's an interesting story right there, where, you know, again, the situation was created where victory was denied so they could prolong the war.
I just wanted to say, my take on that, look, that whole thing had been worked out with the Chinese long in advance, in my opinion. I mean, the Chinese were under the influence of the Bolshevik at this time. Mao was, you know, basically from Skull and Bones. I mean,
he was a Yalie,
So the idea that we would end up with half of Korea, you know, is kind of vassal state.
Oh, by the way, and ask something, you remember the UN resolution to police the Korean Peninsula was passed because the Soviet Union at the time decided to boycott it over recognizing, I guess, the mainland China by the UN. But this was a pretext for the Soviet Union to not be there, so that the resolution was passed. They could have vetoed it as a member of the Security Council. So another, you know, great magical coincidence.
Yeah. But it's just, if we, you know, it'd be kind of fun one day, I don't know, to go through all of the wars step by step. I mean, all the way back to like the 30-year war, the French Revolution, all of the Masonic are, you know, and the ones that are not obvious, we should do enough research so that we can kind of put them into context. I think, you know, like you were saying earlier, like, well, there hasn't been a legitimate war in over 100 years. I think that's absolutely correct. Maybe 200 years. I don't know. It's just the wars are the rationale. And I don't think, I mean, money is obviously going to be made. If you know war is going to be fought, you will clearly, you know, it's a large, and they would like to take wealth away from us. And they would like to possess wealth. They have.
Well, that's one thing. It is war is a huge, huge wealth transfer scheme. Not to mention the the social engineering and social alchemy that's conducted during the war. It's a huge wealth transfer. I think we're still paying off the debt from the First World War.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
think about it as compound interest. The gift that keeps on giving.
And so that's the thing, is that the wars are...
And who owns the banks that that creates the currency to fund those loans?
Oh. Yeah, who does? God, the Rothschilds have just made a living for a couple hundred years benefiting from Europeans slaughtering themselves. You know, I mean, it's that actually is kind of a good way of looking at the world, is that Europeans slaughter themselves. The Rothschilds find ways to make money off every single one, representing the Masonic banking, you know, Jewish elite family world. And the political class doesn't pay any attention at all to the needs of the public not to be genocided, right? That isn't a legitimate political need somehow.
No, when there's an obstacle like the U.S. Constitution to some sort
forget
of,
about it.
You know, like, I don't know, the fact that conscription is completely unconstitutional, but when they need
Or war without congressional approval. Well, or even making money without congressional approval. I mean, the Constitution has just been completely ignored by the oligarchs as they set up the slave state. And
that's the right. The non-delegation clause forbids Congress from delegating its powers to any other branch or body. And what do they do with the Federal Reserve Act?
They delegated away the most important power that they had, the creation of money and credit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so the political class is basically corrupt, you know, so, and this is our problem. I mean, our basic problem, Tim, is, and it's the problem in Armistice, and it's in the problem in everything, is that the political class is a secret society. You know, I have my position on it, and I think, you know, I have analysis and evidence that I am correct. But look, this should be everybody's problem. There should be nothing else but study of the political class. I mean, if you are worried about the future of Europe and Europeans, there's only one question, is that who's leading us? Who are they? What are they? You know, why do we continue to slaughter ourselves? You know, it's just this is what we have to answer. And so, you know, let's hope that my little financial tip at the beginning of the show about the reset. However, if I'm right, Tim, you know, this is I don't want to, you know, claim to be a financial advisor, but I hope people who you know, sense something is really wrong with the financial system Sunday and short the market and the dumper. Well, remember us, you know, in their wills or something, because you know, if it is, you know, what I fantasize, this would be you know, a time when they would do just a complete reset. So the thing is, it's so obvious a date for them to do it. That's one of the reasons why I kind of don't think they will, because it would hardly be believable. And you know, the other thing, you know, people talk about, well, it's, you know, it's like there's going to be a complete extermination of the population, will be, you know, wiped out. I don't think so. If they were going to do that, they wouldn't be working so hard to create the Delta class. You know, you look at all these autism shows where they're normalizing autism. I mean, I think that really what you're in for is a series of shocks. I mean, they may wipe out the dollar, which would be pretty grim, but I think that the real goal here is to create the Delta and the Epsilon. I think that's where really what the oligarchs have in mind, sex slaves and just you know, mindless individuals who can do nothing but obey. That's really what the goal is.
Well, they've gone a long way towards that with creating generations of sex robots and bean counters, and that's what the educational system, and that's what the war on the family and community is all about, because you create, you know, sort of atomized, deracinated communities or people, and that's what they turned into, especially when they're, you know, they imbibe all the popular culture that the establishment produces for them. That's, yeah, you know, all done in the name of freedom and, you know, and fun, I guess. Right now we're, you know, it's what they've done is they've used all the cultural economic pressure to create this situation, because you no longer have, again, the communities, or the people don't have the benefit of families or extended families or communities, and they're atomized, and they just have themselves and what they can watch on their iPhone.
Yeah, you know, people that want to like look at the process by which culture was debased, and particularly the Catholic aspect, should listen to that interview you did last week. I told you before the show how taken I was with it. Can you give us information on that as to how people can get to that? Because that was a great interview.
Oh, I was a guest on the show, the Myth of the 20th Century, and the topic was Catholic power and the American Empire, and I more or less talked about the importance of American Catholicism more from a political science standpoint than a theological standpoint, and how it perhaps at one point represented a competing power block to sort of the ruling elite in America, and how it had to be smashed.
And I was fascinated by, like, one of the data points you brought up was that the baby boom as a European phenomenon was mainly a Catholic phenomenon.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I mean, that's quite interesting. And you can see why then the Catholic neighborhoods were so focused upon, because that's where the population shift was occurring. And it was, it was a group that the oligarchs hated, Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, and the sort of the temptation or the lure that is America, which is a Masonic project, from the get-go sort of infected American Catholicism. The fact that American Catholics could be successful and have a place at the table at the Masonic feast. And that was sort of a temptation. And, you know, that's why most, look at most Catholic politicians, right? They're anything but Catholic. In order to become a successful Catholic politician, you have to shed anything that resembles Catholicism, you know.
Pro abortion.
Joe Biden, Tim Kaine, you know, Nancy Pelosi. And even on the right, I'm not just picking on the left. The right, then the right wing Catholics become warmongers for Israel, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone like Biden is a crypto. I just do not believe he is a legitimate moron. if you ever seen his this one YouTube video of him declaring himself a Zionist, he's with some Israeli guy who comes up, and Biden practically French kisses the guy. He's just so passionate about, it's not a normal, kind of geopolitical data point. There's just something visceral, that isn't normal or natural in his relationship with
him. He praised Jews for bringing about gay marriage in his speech. he's right.
it's like Sean Hannity and Biden. The thing about those guys that I think you can really that really makes me so suspicious is they always get on TV on Ash Wednesday with the ash on their forehead. Have you noticed that? I've seen it like five times. I mean, these guys are always there. You see Biden walking around with the ash, and you go, I don't know, Joe. I mean, it's like, what is Catholic about you?
Yeah.
There just isn't any Catholicism in term. And you see, what I really liked about the interview you did is you talked about Catholicism as a way of defending Europeans, and how when it lost its sort of identity, that it all, what really was going on, it was losing its capacity to defend the European ethnicity, and it's kind of almost a little more semantically complicated, because really what it was is Catholicism was one of the ways that the ethnicities were able to stay unified.
Yeah, it was, you had Christendom, which was at the time, Catholicism, the church, the international church, at the same time, different ethnic groups are Germans, French, Italians were all Catholic, but they're also distinctly Italian, German, and French at the same time.
And it's like people often ask, and they go, well, sometimes you seem like you're so pro-Catholicism, and you wrote Caesar's Messiah, where you're talking about the origins of the religion in a very, revisionist way. Isn't this a contradiction? And I go, not really. What I really see is a political class that is completely malevolent, and many things about Catholicism were the bulwark. They were how the ethnicity was protected. So you have to look at religions not just from a theological, but from an ethnic and a political perspective.
Also maintaining an idea of objective universal morality, which the oligarchs hate.
Absolutely.
Well, we got to buy. We got to follow.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I mean the way that we've gotten to where like movies like Zero Dark Thirty and the gay disco political class that E. Michael Jones kind of writes on, is because the just the idea of a moral structure was taken away. And it was I think that the culture of critique, the way the cultural Marxists did it, is that when they attacked the Catholic Church, and particularly like with the pedophile and the priest scandals, mm-hmm. is that they were also subliminally attacking the moral structure that the church represented.
Yes.
Because the church was the moral structure. I went to Catholic schools my whole elementary life, and I was an altar boy, and the Catholic Church represented, to me anyway, sort of the basis of a moral, family-oriented culture.
Well, it's one thing that E. Michael Jones made a point, and you'll probably second this, is that the moral environment of these schools in the 50s and 60s were fundamentally different. I mean, people just didn't behave. They were behaving by the 1980s, and people in the 80s and 90s and now don't find that hard to believe. But one thing that was revealed in the Kavanaugh hearings was sort of this debased party environment, in these high school kids in the 80s, because they're imbibing all these movies and these things, Risky Business or Class. These movies are coming out to shows how you're supposed to behave, and in the 70s, Animal House and these things, Porky's. And so they're imbibing all this stuff. He's saying, well, when he was in preparatory school in the early 60s, it just none of this was going on in the Catholic schools. It just wasn't. And things had fundamentally changed by the 80s. Now, what was the source of that social alchemy? Well, it was the sexual revolution. It was Hollywood and these things. There is agency behind this, and there are individuals that are personally responsible for changing how people behave.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's why, like, the alchemy, when you look at, like, the Lewinsky affair, which is just an example of what I think, artificial, kind of all the worlds is a stage and a propaganda stage element, where they were able to talk about, risque sex acts in front of kids.
Yes.
on the evening news, right? And it was the president of the United States that they were talking about. So, the attack is just all constant. And the way that you can protect yourself against it is first by being aware of it and trying to separate to the extent you can, like with communities. We've talked about that there are communities that people can create and be part of, which are not in and of themselves psychological destroyers.
Yeah.
You can look for such communities. And it's one thing, like with the Plotkin video, the YouTube video. God, I hope that gets a lot of play. Because if people see that, they will realize that there is just no way that you should ever permit your kid to be vaccinated. I mean, believe me, we would need, in order to get to the point where this would be reasonable, we would need an enormous investigation. I don't even know who could conduct it, to see what exactly is in back of this, the vaccination science, because you can see that there is real evil lurking there. And so when you think about, like, in California, where the kids have to have like 66 vaccinations, mm-hmm. in public school, well, this would be, in my mind, like, the dividing line. This would be the moment where the parent goes, I just can't go forward. I got to get the kid away. I have to find another community.
Yeah.
I have to create another community. I have to get off my ass and do the hard work of establishing another kind of community. a non-pornographic, non-vaccinating. I mean, you know, maybe with some moral structures that may have existed in like St. Lawrence Martyr Elementary School in 1959,
yeah,
where I was at, you know, where you did not, I mean, the idea of pornography was just not in the consciousness.
And people don't understand that now.
No.
People cannot believe that people behave differently. Women behave differently. They were more protective of themselves.
That's why, like the Veterans Day Armistice thing is so, you know, insidious, because they're representing, you know, the fallen soldier and the memory. When the fact is, what it should be about, what Armistice Day should be about, was fallen moral structure.
Well, that's what war does.
What's lost, you know?
What does war do when you blow apart a city or you separate husbands from their wives or take boys away from the farm and send them off to some battlefield? How do you get the boy to go back to the farm once they've seen Gay Paris, as they said, after World War One? Well, what they're saying is after you visit the whorehouses in France, he doesn't want to go back. This is the lights of Paris. He doesn't want to go back to the mundane life on the farm doing something actually useful and productive. Obviously we'll talk about, you know, we can talk about the effect that war has on families. We see it these videos that they sell where like father comes home and surprises their daughter after being away for a year, or you see a mother being torn away from her infant child to go when she's being deployed, and we're supposed to celebrate this. And that you should be ashamed of that. Or you're seeing, you know, women missing limbs because they're basically been put in combat positions, or what they call combat, especially just areas where there's insurgencies and there's bombs going off. It's not like they're fighting an army or anything like that. We should be ashamed of that. But yet we're supposed to celebrate and be proud of it, make us feel good in these things. Well, you know, the divorce rate among military families, what's the divorce, what the effect it has on families? You know, the fact that the biggest operative daycare, we call child warehousing, is actually the Pentagon. What does that do to family structure? Because the families are so split up in these things and screwed up because of the wars. This is what it does. But again, we're supposed to, you know, just salute like good citizens and salute our soldiers. Stand, put our hand above our hearts when they sing the Star Spangled Banner at the football game, when you had a baseball game. I remember going to a baseball game. This was back about 6, 8, 9 years ago. I went to a major league baseball game in the seventh inning. You're supposed to stand for our troops. And, you know, I didn't.
Yeah.
But believe me, there's a lot of pressure. People are looking at you.
Yeah, I would take the knee.
Yeah, take the knee.
I have a close family member who was a flight attendant for Pan Am in the 60s. And she told me that she actually flew into Da Nang doing little tight corkscrew circles so the plane wouldn't be shot out of the sky. This was like a Pan Am, like 707 or something like that. And she said that she flew the soldiers R&R, right? That's what they would do. They'd go into Nang, get them, and they would take them to, you know, Bangkok or to Australia. But she said that basically these were just whorehouse conveyor belts.
Yeah.
That was what the soldiers were actually organized to basically spend their R&R whoring. And she said that the drug use was just beyond belief. You know, they were taking heroin and narcotics. And I asked her, I said, well, were you ever like, you know, worried when you were attending these people, you know? And she said, no, they were too drugged out. I said, really, the whole plane? She goes, yeah, they were just doped, you know, and there'd be a bus that would take them to a whorehouse, and that would be the R&R. And so you can see that they would shatter the kids in the battlefield with horror.
Yeah. Yep.
Shatter their soul with the drugs, and then they would shatter their morality with the whorehouses that they would arrange, so that then when they dropped them off, you know, in LAX at the end of their term, they were all ready for the youth culture, right? They could just plug them right in. You know, here you go. So it's just, you know, okay. So this is how they've done it to us, and this is what we've got to deal with. But how do you fight back? Well, you know, you can't. They've isolated us. That's one thing. So you've got to create community. You've got to get off your ass and do the hard work. You know, of establishing first of all marriage or, you know, that kind of relationship, and then plugging that into a community of such individuals, and then going about the business of educating your kid. There's nothing. There's no other way. The public schools, you know, I mean, I wish they could be transformed, but I just can't believe it. I know so many people in that system who are heroic and who are great teachers. But the problem is they're swimming upstream because the system is ruled by cultural Marxism. Mm-hmm. And they want the end product to be just like the soldier who came back from Vietnam. They just want a sex, drug, and rock and roll zombie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean that's what war is good for, is shattering. It's one vast social engineering scheme. That's one thing. It's not something to be memorialized, even if it's done in the name of the troops or putting flowers in front of someone's tomb or something in Arlington National Cemetery. The problem with that is it obscures or ignores the bigger issue, is why was that war fought in the first place? And you should concentrate on those questions. And instead of worrying about memorializing fallen soldiers, his so-called sacrifice, the fact that he ended up being cannon fodder for some imperial war or some banker's war, focus attention on the political leadership and the financial interests behind these wars that caused them in the first place. And maybe you might get some accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. Know. All right, Tim. Well, I think you've done a great job of celebrating Armistice Day here. And if my paranoid fantasy about, 100-year anniversary doesn't come true, I'll see you next week, buddy.
Take care. Enjoy the weekend. Right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.